The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, Shavua Tov, how are you? How was your Shabbat? How was your Purim? Tell us everything.
Boker Tov, Shavua Tov. Yeah, Purim was a slightly different experience this year around for sure, because there was quite a lot of rush on Thursday evening for the Megillah reading, because of course we went into a curfew over the weekend to try to prevent people from gathering together. So Megillah readings were quite early. It's a little bit unusual. By 8:30, people were kind of off the streets and going into the curfew situation. So it was pretty quiet on Thursday. And of course, also with Purim falling as it did on Friday, which is a little more difficult and quite an unusual situation. And then Purim, of course, Shushan Purim being celebrated in Jerusalem on Saturday evening and Sunday, it was a little disparate. So I don't think it was kind of the sort of Purim that we're usually accustomed to, seeing people dressing up all over the place in a festive spirit. But certainly there was Purim. And apparently people weren't really sticking to the rules, because, you know, the weather was really good. And even though the curfew was in place from 8:30 in the evening until 5:30 the following morning on Thursday night, Friday night and Saturday night, people found ways to somehow circumvent the curfew, and managed to get together in some quite large numbers. There were some quite worrying situations and stories about people doing almost anything to circumvent the rules that were in place, including gatherings of people in shuls to hear the Megillah reading, and including parties that were being thrown both within the ultra-Orthodox sect in Jerusalem. People apparently reported to be walking miles to get to Jerusalem because all the bus routes had been cancelled in order to exactly prevent people from gathering in large numbers. And yet people were going by foot, going in any which possible way in order to get wherever they wanted to go. And let's not forget some of the things that carried on in Tel Aviv, especially on Friday and Saturday, the Shuka Pishpishim, the flea market in Jaffa, which is now less of a flea market and more of a kind of very upcoming, trendy sort of bar, restaurant neighborhood, lots of outdoor seating areas, lots of bars and restaurants and pubs in that area of Jaffa. It's become very trendy indeed. Well, apparently the parties that were going on in Jaffa on Friday and Saturday were something to behold. Also equally in the market in Machane Yehuda in Jerusalem, also in the market to Shuka Carmel in Tel Aviv, and also at the Namal Tel Aviv, the port area of Tel Aviv, which also has a lot of entertainment areas. Apparently people were gathering there in very, very large numbers indeed. There were fines handed out. There were people who were apparently, picked out and fined for transgressing the rules that were laid down, but apparently nowhere near enough. And if we have a look at the number of people who are transgressing these rules, it's just quite astonishing. Now, I know that almost 5 million Israelis have already received both vaccinations, and there's another 3 odd million, I think, that have, received the other way around. Almost 5 million Israelis have received at least one vaccination, and more than 3.5 million have already received both of their vaccinations. So there is certainly an expectation that we have a level of immunity being built into the general society. But apparently that's not enough. And we still have so many under 16-year-olds who have not been vaccinated and who are still very susceptible to not only getting the coronavirus, but also, of course, passing it on. And even though we understand that a lot of them don't feel particularly ill, when they do contract the virus, there are reports of them suffering from significant long-term illnesses, having recovered from the virus. So we are concerned about that. And now we are being threatened with some quite severe, stringent lockdown prevention rules over Pesach as a result of what's been happening over Purim, which almost kind of sounds like what happened last year. And yeah, we just wonder if we've learned anything. It's kind of just feels more of the same, you know, except that this time around, I think a lot of people are thinking, well, because we all have been vaccinated, or so many of us have been vaccinated, we need not be concerned and we need not be cautious anymore. But that's not the message that we're getting from the health authorities. So a lot of mixed things going on. On the one hand, the vaccination program, very, very good. But the question is, does it lead people to be more lax in the way that they have to apply the stringent regulations in order to prevent people from becoming ill.
So what is likely to happen now with regard to all of the rules? Because I saw a couple of articles yesterday saying that they might have to wait to see if there's been an impact on the behavior, on spread over Purim in order to decide how much further to open up.
Well, I think that, you know, as Albert Bourla said, the CEO of Pfizer, Israel is one big lab at the moment. We are the world's laboratory in terms of testing all of this out. And I think Purim is going to be a very, very significant test of how strong this vaccination program really is and how much it affects our society, because certainly people are testing it to the limits. Absolutely. When we see what went on over the weekend, then there's no doubt that people are really testing the strength of this vaccination and whether it's going to hold up. My expectation is that there will be a slight uptick in the number of people being affected, but I sincerely hope that the vaccination will really come to its own and will prevent a major outbreak as we saw last year, where of course people hadn't been vaccinated and we didn't really know how to respond to the situation. So I think we really have to wait 2 weeks to see whether the whole getting together over Purim story has contributed to a significant increase in the number of people who've fallen ill, or whether the increase has potentially been somewhat controlled as a result of the vaccination program. So I think we're all waiting now with bated breath to see what happens next. I don't think anybody can really predict what's going to happen now, but we're all hopeful that the vaccination is going to be the strongest influencing factor of what happens over the next 2 weeks.
Yep, and I'm sure that we'll start to see, if anything, hopefully we won't see anything, but we might start to see that in a few days, because Purim was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. By tomorrow, if that is the case, we will start, unfortunately, to see a rise in cases. Israel stands accused of carrying out attacks against Iranian targets. That's in Syria, after the Israeli-owned cargo ship was damaged in the Gulf of Oman. So just tell us about this. We reported on the story a little bit earlier, but it's a bit vague what happened to this vessel.
Well, I think there's a double-edged sword going on with regard to this Israeli-owned vessel carrying automobiles, apparently from Saudi Arabia to Singapore, that was hit in its bow, either by a missile or by an underwater mine, we're not exactly sure, which caused some damage to the vessel, but not severe damage, and nobody was injured on board the ship, and certainly the ship managed to continue along its way without sinking or without having to stop. So the damage, it seems, was relatively limited and controlled. But a lot of speculation, and as I say, a bit of a double-edged sword about whether we want to talk about it a lot or whether we don't want to talk about it a lot, because talking about it a lot really gives some credit to Iran for potentially carrying out this attack, if indeed that is what happened, because it's only speculation that this was carried out by Iran. I think they did actually publicly come out and try to lay claim to this particular attack. I'm not quite sure if that's opportunistic or if that was something that they really were involved in. We don't really know. But we do know that Iran has had the weapons already ready to roll. They've had plans to try to retaliate against a number of attacks that Israel is accused of carrying out against some senior Iranian figures, including the top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was killed in November just outside of Tehran in a very, very sophisticated attack. And we know that Iran likes to retaliate against these things, and they didn't do so immediately. And it would seem as if, though, they haven't really carried out any significant retaliation since then. Apparently there was an attempt, I think, to attack the Israeli embassy in New Delhi last month, but really nothing more than that. So one looks at this event in the Gulf of Oman as a potential retaliation by the Iranian authorities to try to carry out a revenge attack against Israel. If that's what it was, it seems to have been very, very limited in how effective it's been. And Israel has retaliated right away without any hesitation, and there can be absolutely no doubt. And I say there's no doubt, but there is doubt, because even though these explosions took place in the southern part of Damascus last night against targets that are very much Iranian focused, Iranian owned assets within southern Syria. We know that Iran has got a very significant setup in that southern Damascus neighborhood area of Syria, and Israel has constantly focused its attacks against that particular area. Last night was no exception, even though the Syrian authorities have reported that all the weapons, all the missiles that were used to try to attack Syria from the Golan Heights, they reported, were effectively shot down by anti-missile systems in Syria. But certainly there were reports of explosions. We don't know anything about any damage that was done, but we know that when Israel has its intentions to go in and damage, carry out attacks in Syria, they've generally been quite successful. So we've seen the ship that was an Israeli-owned cargo ship that was damaged in the Gulf of Oman, which we think was an attack by Iran. We think now that Israel, it would seem as at least that Israel had gone in last night to carry out attacks against Iranian targets in Syria, but they all seem to be relatively low key, particularly when we compare it to the assassination of Fakhrizadeh, which was a very, very high profile, not only the way in which the attack was carried out, but the individual concern was very high profile. So that's really regarded as a much, much, much greater attack than the ones that we've seen over the last few days. But it seems to me as if, though, at least these attacks that we've seen since the end of last week against that ship and now in Syria as well, are really all part of the same string of attack and counterattack and retaliation one against the other in order to make sure that each of the various regimes understand that there is always a consequence to anything that they do. Having said that, I would have thought that the Israeli authorities are sitting quietly this morning thinking, if that's the price we had to pay for killing Fakhrizadeh, then, you know, it's probably been worthwhile. But I don't know yet whether this is all over.
Yeah, it does seem to be escalating. It's become, you know, whereas in the past you and I have spoken about this, these attacks on Iranian targets in Syria were quite covert, no one ever took responsibility. It's now, over the last couple of months, it became more overt. Now we're seeing Iran attacking a vessel. We're seeing an open retaliation for that. It definitely does seem to be becoming an acceptable, if in inverted commas, manner in which these parties are behaving, which ultimately leads to an escalation, I would think.
I'm not quite sure whether it's more of an escalation or whether it's just much more public. Once upon a time, you're right. I mean, things like this happened and there was really an attempt to hush and to not talk about it, and nobody took responsibility for us, and it kind of went away from the press relatively quickly without any further discussion. But these days, it's becoming much more public. And even in December, the Israeli Chief of General Staff, Aviv Kochavi, made a statement that said that Israel had attacked 500 targets in Syria during 2020. So one has to then assume that these attacks overnight, which we see so frequently and which nobody formally takes any responsibility for, do seem to be at least coming from Israel, if one believes what Aviv Kochavi said in December. So, nobody's really taking responsibility, but I don't know who else would be attacking Iranian targets in that southern Damascus area. We do know, for example, that the U.S. Forces carried out an attack in Syria last week. They took responsibility for it. They put their hands up. Everybody knew that it was carried out by the U.S. There was absolutely no doubt at all in anybody's minds. And yet this attack last night and so many others that we've spoken about and we've seen, even those that we haven't spoken about, have just not been claimed. There's been no claim made by any authority as to who actually carried out these attacks. And so my working assumption for now is that Israel is very much involved, because Israel is the only one who has all the interest to carry out an attack like this. And certainly in the days following that attack against the Israeli-owned cargo, it seems that Israel would have even more interest to carry out this attack than ever before.
Anthony, we don't have a lot of time, but just tell me quickly, Benny Gantz been reported to have held a series of meetings with King Abdullah of Jordan. What lies behind these meetings?
It's not clear whether Benny Gantz is meeting the King of Jordan in his capacity as Defense Minister of Israel and Israeli government, or whether he is meeting King Abdullah as the head of the Blue and White Party going into the next election, where he is very, very likely to be going things alone, and so therefore trying somehow to raise his own personal profile and the profile of the party that he represents, not part of his governmental duties. This is not very clear at all, but we do understand that he has met on a number of occasions with the Jordanian king. He claimed that he has continuous and ongoing contact with the Jordanians. I'm not quite sure what that means, but apparently these meetings have been so-called secret meetings, which have subsequently been published in the press. And we do understand, in addition to that, that there have been a number of meetings between Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi, who's met with his Jordanian counterpart at least twice over the last couple of months. So again, it's unclear whether those meetings are governmental meetings or whether these are meetings ahead of a general election where everybody's really trying to position themselves to do better in the election and to position themselves as a potential leader after the election. But certainly a lot of communication going on over there. And I think my general comment about the relationship with Jordan is that even though King Abdullah very frequently comes out and makes quite negative comments about Israel and really is seen to be the protector of the holy sites of Jerusalem on behalf of the Muslim nation and the Arab world in general, I think that behind that lies quite a close relationship and cooperation between Jordan and Israel, which I think is concealed to some degree by some of these public statements that the King of Jordan makes in order to try to position himself as being acceptable within the Muslim and within the Arab world.
Absolutely. Fascinating development and very, very positive in so many ways. Anthony Reich, that is where we leave it. We'll catch you tomorrow morning, same time, same place. That's Anthony Reich with the Israel Report. It's just gone 8 o'clock. I'm Howard Feldman. A very good morning.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.